You are listening to the Cycling Podcast, proudly supported by Lacca. Whether you're lining up for a Gran Fondo in the Alps, chasing the cobbled classics in Belgium, or heading on a dream cycling trip abroad, the last thing you want to worry about is what happens if something goes wrong. Every ride comes with its risks, whether it's a stolen bike, a crash, or a broken derailleur at the worst possible moment. That's why Lacca Bicycle Insurance exists, because when things go wrong, Lacca has your back. So let's talk about what really makes Lacca's bicycle insurance tick. It's their customer service. Claims are handled by Lacca's in-house team of experts with no depreciation or excess on bike claims. The team at Lacca has your back when you need them most. They've even been crowned the best bike insurance provider at the Insurance Choice Awards for 7 years running. And it's no surprise when you check their ratings. They have 4.9 stars on Google, 4.6 stars on Trustpilot, and over 2,300 five-star reviews on Smart Money People. But don't just take Lacca's word for it. Check out this testimonial from Rehan on Trustpilot, who raves about their top-notch customer service.
Love you, Lacca. Sasha was friendly, helpful, kind, and great to deal with. The first thing I was asked was whether I was hurt, and if so, was I okay? I really appreciated this and felt human rather than just a customer. My claim was easy to deal with and the service was tip top. Best bike insurance out there. Thank you, Lacca, Sasha and team.
So if you want specialist bike insurance that truly goes the extra mile, head over to lacca.co and see why more and more cyclists are choosing Lacca. Sign up today and experience the best customer service in the game. Lacca alive in the United Kingdom, the Netherlands, France, Belgium and Germany. So the Cycling Podcast listeners in these regions get their first 30 days free, which includes travel cover when they sign up with the code TCP30 at lacca.co/TCP. That code is TCP30 at lacca.co/TCP. Terms and conditions apply. You know what to do.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello and joining you on April the 17th, 2025, after a weekend when Tadej Pogacar proved that sub-70 kilo climbers can contend for Paris-Roubaix after all. So expect a Van der Poel-Lenny Martinez showdown at the Hell of the North next year. My name's Daniel Freeba. I'm the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which I'll strain every sinew, not to mention either golf or football, and slowly beckon you from the flatlands and cobbles of Flanders and northern France towards the wooded hills of Limburg and the Ardennes. Here to help me with that endeavour today is a man equally at home on both types of terrain. That is Lionel Burney, and he knows exactly what I'm referring to when I mentioned golf and football.
That's right, and Daniel. Yeah, Rory McIlroy has reached the Champions League semi-final. Well done, Rory.
And with him and me, a bike rider, suddenly so averse to any form of cycling north of the Rhone Valley, classics or otherwise, that he's gone into hiding in the extreme south of Spain and the Sierra Nevada mountain range, vowing not to emerge until Mathieu van der Poel has been pictured on a beach in the Maldives. It's the Motel Maestro, Larry Walbass.
Hey guys, good to be here.
In his mountain hideaway, Larry. Just describe where exactly you are, please.
So yeah, we are in Sierra Nevada in the south of Spain.
Who's we, Larry?
I'm with the team here. So currently we are four riders. So for a long time we were three of us, Florian Stork, Michael Storer, and myself. And then now Rick Ploymers has also joined us. We are here with a small group of staff. We have a coach, a Swanee, a mechanic, and a chef. So it's a pretty good setup. We aren't staying in the car, which is like the sports center, Centro Alto Rendimiento or something like that.
The car, not just a car. We had Lionel in a car in a lay-by a couple of weeks ago after the Tour of Flanders, but you're talking about a different kind of car.
Yeah, so that's like the place that a lot of athletes go. Because it's like an athlete high-performance center at altitude. And if you go alone, it's a really good setup. I've gone there a few times myself, but Yeah, if you have the team support, I think the best setup is like how we have now. We have two apartments, one for the riders, one for the staff. And yeah, it's been pretty nice. For the most part, the weather was really good, although the last couple of days we had some snow. So yeah, we had to change around the training a little bit. But for the most part, it's been great weather, great training. And yeah, I think we're ready for Tour the Alps and then the Giro.
Wow. Ready to go big at the Giro, Larry.
I am. Yeah.
We're expecting very big things from you. Well, Larry, we're going to talk about your altitude preparation. We're going to actually discuss maybe whether altitude even works later on, because we've been talking off mic about that. But first, Larry, traditionally these days we begin our episodes with something we call the newsette, in which Lionel and I, you're exempt, Larry, much like you're exempt from the classics. Lionel and I, we will introduce a couple of talking points, things that have caught our eye in the news headlines in professional cycling over the last week. Lionel, what have you got for us this week?
Well, mine is a very small nugget tucked away in the corner of our newsette. Something that I'm interested in because I went to the UCI Gravel World Championships in Leuven last October, made a friend of the podcast episode, which Larry featured on, actually. Larry and Ian Boswell featured in, talking about the kind of the journey that cycling in general has been on, the sort of overlap between gravel racing and road racing. But we heard a couple of months ago that Nice, which was supposed to be hosting this year's UCI Gravel World Championships, would be unable to do so. And so the UCI has had a bit of a scramble to find an alternative host. And last week, or a few days ago at any rate, it was confirmed that Maastricht in the Netherlands, that sort of southern, it's southern Limburg, I think, isn't it? Right in the corner, not far from the Belgian border, really Amstel Gold territory, isn't it? That will be hosting the UCI Gravel World Championships on October the 11th, which is the same weekend as Ile Lombardia. So that will remain to be seen. Whether being held there attracts a lot of the kind of Belgian and Dutch classic stars, be impossible for the Belgians to have an even bigger team than they had at the last edition. I think it was dozens of riders lining up for Belgium. But there we are. The UCI Gravel World will be in the Netherlands this year, and it'll be the fourth edition, I think.
No longer than in Larry's neck of the woods was due to be, as you say, Lionel, in Nice. That would have been very convenient for the Motown Maestro. Lionel, Larry, I have got two things for us this week that have caught my eye. One, the announcement that this is going to be the last professional season for another good friend of the podcast, another one of our emissaries in the peloton, Alessandro De Marchi, who these days rides for Jayco Alula. He is, I believe, also going to be riding the Giro. 38 years old. He will be concluding a career that's lasted 15 seasons, turned pro with Gianni Savio's old team, Androni, joined Cannondale, BMC. I actually thought that he was your teammate for a while at BMC, Larry, but that was not the case. CCC, Israel, and he spent the last 3 years at Jayco. 7 career wins, including 3 Vuelta stages, the Trevali Varesina, Giro dell'Emilia, and the stage of the Dauphiné. And of course, he wore the pink jersey in 2021 at Sestola, when our other good mate, Joe Dombrowski, won the stage. Now, regular listeners of the podcast will know that Alessandro is a very thoughtful chap, very principled chap. Certainly, if you follow him on social media, very politically engaged and regularly sort of takes part in, lends his support to charitable initiatives. One of the more well-known ones has been the wine that he has lent his name to over the last few years, Rosso di Buia. That's his nickname, the sort of red Buia, which is the town where he comes from in Friuli in the extreme northeast of Italy. And part of the proceeds from sales of that wine, they go to a charity which works to tackle droughts or the effects of droughts, I believe, in Africa. So, last lap of the World Tour and last lap of Italy for Alessandro De Marchi in May at the Giro. So, we look forward to catching up with him there. Another thing, chaps,
just
my other item
De Marchi,
for the week. Sorry, go on.
Also at Sierra Nevada at the moment. He's a fellow gym rat, because every time we go to the gym in the center, he's there. So I think he's getting yoked as well, so he'll be good in the Giro.
Have you had any nice chats with him?
No, just a little acknowledgement every time we pass. But yeah.
And indeed, you were not his teammate at BMC. You missed him by a year. You were gone from BMC in 2016, weren't you? Or 2015, even.
I was already gone, yeah.
Yes. My second item, Lionel, Larry, was that the Swedish rider, Jakob Söderqvist, 21 years old, is going to be turning professional with Little Trek World Tour Team in 2026. Now, he's caught a lot of people's eye already this season, notably for a fantastic performance in the Vuelta Valenciana earlier in the year when he was sort of leading out Jonathan Milan. But also last weekend when he was second behind his Little Trek Development Team teammate, Albert Witten Philipson. Big old boy, Jakob Söderqvist. I think he's 187 centimetres tall. Very good time trial. He's very talented by all accounts. And I think he's someone who will make waves in the World Tour next year. Interesting trivia question, chaps. He's got something in common with Mark Cavendish. And we could sit here for 3 hours and you wouldn't be able to tell me what it is. He, like Mark Cavendish, finished outside of the time limit in a race that finished at La Rosière, a ski resort in the Alps. In Söderqvist's case, it was the Tour de l'Avenir last year. In Cavendish's case, it was the 2018 Tour de France, of course. And a name that I'll be interested to follow also because of this Swedish paradox in professional cycling. Now, of the Scandinavian countries, Sweden has been the one that's been sort of the most poorly served by professional cycling in recent years. Of course, they have had some illustrious riders in the past, Gösta Pettersson, he was part of a famous dynasty, famous cycling family. He won the Giro in 1971, was third in the Tour de France, and Magnus Backstead won Paris-Roubaix in 2004. But Sweden, it's a country with double the population of Denmark and Norway, but certainly those two nations have been much better represented in recent years. So Söderqvist, Swedes will be hoping that he redresses that slightly.
Yeah, Little Trek Future Racing, as the development team is called. They're quietly, they're pretty impressive in their sort of talent identification. I was just looking at their roster at the moment, and they're picking up riders based on family connections in a lot of cases. They've got Jonathan Milan, who you mentioned, Daniel. They've got his younger brother, Matteo, on the roster. Niels Ebersold. Daniel, do you remember Nicky Ebersold is his father. He rode for the Phonak team for a few years.
That was one of those, Lionel, when I first saw that name, maybe last year, sometime last year, my sort of, as you would say, my face started to go a bit hot. It was one of those horrible epiphanies where I realised how old I had become.
Exactly. Well, there's also Cameron Rogers, who is the nephew of Michael Rogers, former world time trial champion, whose brother Pete Rogers was a very handy rider in his own right. And another name that, kind of resonates with me, means a bit to me, and a little bit of news from Lidl Trek Future Racing. They've signed a young lad, 16 years old, Leon Atkins, who will be joining the team in 2027. I mean, the talent identification is getting younger and younger. They're going to be picking kids out of kindergarten soon.
Well, these teams, they all have slightly different names for their development team. Some of them call them Devo team or Academy team. Maybe for Little Trek, the Nepo Babies would have been an appropriate name.
Leon Atkins, he rode the junior edition of Paris-Roubaix at the weekend for the Fencham House team, and he's not too far from where I am. He grew up sort of the Hemel Hempstead area of the Chilterns, and I've raced against his dad. I think his dad, Gavin Atkins, a real stalwart of the Hemel Hempstead Cycling Club, and I think Welling Wheelers as well. I'll be keeping an eye on young Leon Atkins' development as he makes his way towards, presumably the World Tour. I mean, they're picking up these riders young, and they've got a real consistent development plan for them going through the development team and into the World Tour team potentially. Not the only team doing that, but certainly, the last few weeks I've noticed quite a lot of movement on Little Trek's front.
Shoot, chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is also sponsored by NordVPN. You can get a great deal on a NordVPN subscription by going to nordvpn.com/TCP. Over the past few weeks, I've been asked a lot about my NordVPN subscription, some of the benefits. The primary one, of course, is internet security, keeping all of your private data safe and secure, stuff like bank details and passwords and your online identity. You can use your NordVPN on up to 10 different devices, so it will cover your phone and laptop, tablets, even your smart TV. And it's the fastest VPN in the world. There's no buffering or lagging while you're streaming. As I said, my main reason for signing up for NordVPN in the first place was just having concerns about my internet security, especially when I was traveling and using public Wi-Fi or connecting to my mobile phone hotspot. Just wanted to be safe in the knowledge that those connections were secure. But there are lots of other benefits too. For example, if you're on holiday or traveling, you can carry on watching your favorite streaming services, which may be geo-restricted, simply by changing your location. It's really very, very easy to use, whether you're connected to NordVPN on your phone or your computer. And to get the best discount, go to nordvpn.com/TCP. Cycling Podcast listeners can get 4 extra months free when they buy a 2-year plan. There's no risk either because Nord offers a 30-day money-back guarantee. We'll put the details in the podcast episode show notes. That's nordvpn.com/TCP.
Well, chaps, we have reached the end of the Cobble Classics. Of course, we had Paris-Roubaix at the weekend, won by Mathieu van der Poel, latest installment of the duel that has characterised the spring between van der Poel and Pogacar. We're going to talk a little bit, get Larry's viewpoint on the Cobble Classics in just a second. But just as a sort of footnote to the last item in the newsette about young riders, particularly Little Trek, Larry, if you cast your mind back, I don't know if you were on this episode, but we do our annual predictions episodes. And this year, I think one of my predictions was that we would see the end of the fetishization of youth in the World Tour, that these sort of 18, 19, 20-year-olds that had turned pro amid great fanfare over the last couple of years. Well, there would be some, maybe some cautionary tales among them that... as I said, this sort of cult of youth might start to ebb and wane a little bit in professional cycling. You know, I mentioned Söderqvist, who when he's come into the World Tour, he's looked fantastic. There are other examples of guys, for example, talking of Nepo babies, that's a pejorative term. I don't want to be pejorative, but illustrious offspring of riders. Markel Bellocchi rides for EF Education First. He's a guy, I think he turned pro at 18. Now, if you were to purely base things on his results, you would say that's a guy who maybe turned pro a little bit too early. I know in that case, what happened was that EF Education thought we need to sign him now because otherwise we're going to miss out on him. But there are quite a few examples like that. There's more and more media coverage about these 18-year-olds. You know, our colleague Daniel Benson talks a lot about them in his Substack, you know, Wunderkinder everywhere coming out of our ears. But some of them look as though they really struggle when they turn pro at 18, 19. Larry, what's the lie of the land on this front?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. We've kind of been having this discussion the last couple of days up here. We were having a discussion with the coach yesterday. And, you know, I have to say, to me, it's like such a case-by-case basis because some of these guys, yeah, they are smashing it and they're ready. You know, I think one example is like my old team, Decathlon. Like they signed this Paul Sexas kid and he's been doing really well, you know, and that's first year out of juniors. So I think, yeah, in that case, it seems to be working just fine. I think also, you know, you have to make sure that they have a program that's sort of developed for them, you know, because they can't be doing only World Tour races. Otherwise, it's maybe too much. But yeah, then there's other cases where it just doesn't work out. And, you know, some of these guys, they go World Tour straight away. And then 2 years later, they're back either done or, you know, on a development team again. So I really think it's like super individual. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it works in enough cases that I don't think we're going to see a reversal too soon. Maybe, you know, maybe a slight reversal, but not a huge shift. I think they're still going to be signing juniors. But, you know, one of the things that I think is an issue is that, like, you know, there are agents representing these guys from like 17, 16,
and that,
15
and that's
years old.
New. And that is really new. That's the Pogacar effect, isn't it?
Yeah. And to me, I think that's a bit dangerous because, like, I mean, okay, for sure, a lot of it has to do, you know, I guess it's their parents that would then, you know, decide on an agent. But I just think the UCI needs to sort of start to step in and say, like, you know, when enough is enough. And maybe as a junior, okay, fine. But, like, if they're signing 15-year-olds as, like, agents, to me, that's a bit too much, you know?
It's a big topic, isn't it, chaps? As you always say, Lionel, there's always young talent coming through, isn't there?
But... Well, it's the way of the world, isn't it? But I think, you know, it's horses for courses, isn't it? Some riders can handle it, some can't. I think, without repeating myself about Lidl Trek, I mean, the advantage they've got there with a real super talent like Albert with Philipsen, you know, they can drop him back down to the development team. And he won the under-23 Paris-Roubaix. I do think there's a danger with young riders going into the World Tour, you know, forgetting how to race, how to win, that what it's all about. And so having that that two-tier system within the same organisation where a rider can drop back down and put the endurance and the things that they've learned from the World Tour level racing into, you know, an age-appropriate level of racing, that's very effective. But, of course, not all World Tour teams have a development team attached, so you know, maybe that is the way that things will evolve over the coming years. Of course, it's additional staffing cost and so forth, but you know, the effective development of young riders is a cost effective way to build a very good team, isn't it? It can be.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing is, if I think back to when I turned pro, there's no way, if you know, if all these guys are going 18, 19 pro, I definitely wasn't ready to go pro at 18, 19. And I wouldn't have been able to, like, living in the U.S., you know, I wouldn't have been able to just move away from home. You know, for my parents, it was important that I went to school, to university. And even though I left university after a few years, I wouldn't have just been able to go straight to Europe. You know, I don't think that would have been an option. And so I also think that's kind of dangerous, that we might lose some guys that otherwise could be great pros eventually, is because maybe they don't have the option to just move everything to Europe when they're 18 years old.
I must say, Larry, partly because of what you've just described and you know, speaking to Joe Dombrowski, our mutual friend, my eye is always trained when we talk about this phenomenon of guys turning too soon and maybe getting lost. My eye is always trained on the North Americans because I know what Joe's experience was and I know what other North Americans' experiences have been and how different racing is there. And, you know, we've heard it many times that guys who are described as super talents and they just seem to get lost. And, you know, often, yeah, a guy, and I'll give you another name, a guy like Michael Leonard on Ineos Grenadiers, roundly described as a super talent, very good time trialist, and you still see that when he does time trials, but he's been a pro for a while now, and just based on results, and again, I don't have any intimate knowledge of his situation, but from the outside it does look as though maybe he could have done with a year or two more before he turned pro. But anyway, shall we talk a little bit about the Cobbled Classics, chaps? Shall we, as our weigh-in, shall we take the weekly diversion that we have been taking in every episode in the Spring Classics via Corvitz Corner? Hugo, take it away.
Pay attention, freebie. After the finish at Paris-Roubaix, I was a silent witness to the family moment at the Van Aerts. The most direct question a journalist could ask, quote, came from Jorge, his eldest son, who is not yet 5 years old. Daddy, why did you come forward again? He asked his father, who was squeezing the brakes in front of him. Because there were three better again, was the gentle and honest answer from Daddy Wout. So simple the question, so simple the answer. Fourth in the Ronde van Vlaanderen and fourth in Paris-Roubaix. With three of the same names on the podium, albeit in a different order. The Grava system to inflate and release pressure in the tires was not enough. It's a good system, said Van Aert. It worked perfectly, but the legs did not. And that remains the essence of this sport. Riding fast when you have to ride fast, as the double X world champion Brik Schotte cycling described years ago. Even though the Amstel Gold Race on Sunday follows the Brabantse Pijl, the most important week of the year is over and there is still a zero behind the name Van Aert. At Visma Liesebike, they said afterwards that they have to go back to the drawing board to possibly draw up a different preparation for the two highlights. In my opinion, Van Aert just did not have enough racing written. He's a rider who gets better once he has gone through the wall. How else do you explain that he could not keep up in Le Bois de Valère-Zarenberg, but got better and better at the end? Due to different circumstances, Visma Liesebike was a shadow of its former self in the Cobblestone Classics. But what about Soudal Quickstep? There was a time when Patrick Lefebvre himself decided from the MAPAGB team car who would be first, second and third. First, Juan Museeuw, second, Gianluca Bortolami, third, Andrea Tafi. And then Franco Ballerini also came fifth behind the three musketeers. In the Museeuw Bonen period, it seemed as if it was child's play for Patrick Lefebvre to win the Ronde van Vlaanderen and or Paris-Roubaix. He won the Ronde 8 times, 6 times Paris-Roubaix. Those times are behind us. On Sunday, Patrick Lefebvre stood alone along a sector pavé, watching. Out of love for Paris-Roubaix. The also-strong team from the past had to eat humble pie again. 3 years ago, the silver fox Patrick Lefebvre also came out of the Cobblestone Classics with a bag of ice on his head. But Remco made up for everything in Liège. And then Patrick Lefebvre, with a big smile, pulled out his evergreen. We always take stock for the first time after Liège-Bastogne-Liège. Does his successor, Jürgen Fory, also have such a rabbit's foot? Wait and see.
Larry, there was Hugo telling us about, well, among other things, how Patrick Lefebvre would have ice on his head. I think that's an interesting translation of a Dutch idiom, but a very vivid and compelling one. In addition to that, Hugo there talked about Wout Van Aert. And what has clearly been a big topic in the cycling media in Belgium, his preparation and the results that followed. And this idea, and I think I even suggested it with my fag packet physiology a few weeks ago, that he looked like a guy who'd spent a lot of time at altitude. The way he was riding, particularly in the first part of the Cobble Classics that he did. And he maybe looked as though he could have done with a bit more racing to be completely al dente, to use the phrase I always do. Larry, you must be an expert on altitude by now. You've been up there for 3 weeks. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, let's hope that it works, because if it doesn't, then up here for a long time for nothing.
Well, you're doing a different kind of race.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I think, you know, it's hard to say, but I do think we've kind of seen a slight shift away from altitude. We haven't seen it. I could tell you by the amount of people who are here for the Giro, there's no shift away. But, you know, we passed like pros just the whole day. But, you know, I thought it was interesting this year that, like, you know, I don't think Tade did an altitude camp before the season. I don't think Vingegaard did a camp before the season. I think these teams are starting to see, like, maybe it's not this, like, panacea that they thought it was. I think also there are probably teams that are realizing that maybe they can get the same effect from heat training. I know last year in the summer, I went all in on heat training instead of going to altitude just so I could stay at home. And I would say I had at least an equivalent gain from doing that. So
equivalent gain in hot.
I would say in terms of performance, but also it appeared in hematological measures. So, you know, I did a blood test before and after. You know, I didn't measure hemoglobin mass where you could really see, you know, whether it had an effect or not. But like, I probably had some of the best blood values, you know, from these regular tests than I had ever.
And did that
even compared to altitude.
And did that translate into performance in both hot environments and mild environments? And it,
I think so. I mean, I felt like super. I felt like great, you know, in all the races I was doing, even if they weren't hot. Especially when they were hot, I could feel that like I had an advantage over the others. But even when it was like temperate or mildly temperate, I really felt like I had a benefit. And then even, you know, this year before Oman, I did a lot of heat training. And what I found was that, like, for example, for the same power output, it seemed like my heart rate was like 10 beats lower, which is actually huge, you know, after like a really big block of heat training. So I do think there are like a lot of benefits to be gained from that. So it's also possible that a lot of teams are doing this. And then the other benefit from that is like you are at sea level or whatever altitude you're at. And you can then train harder and then just kind of add this on at the end. And, you know, I think the other thing about it is because it's such a huge like cardiovascular stress. But muscularly, it's not a big stress because like you go really slow, you know, like you're not doing very many watts. And I think it's a super light load on the muscles. So perhaps maybe you can even add a little bit more training because like it's so intense cardiovascularly, like, you know, your heart rate will just be going through the roof when you're on like a recovery ride pace on the home trainer. So, I think a lot of teams are using that. You know, I saw like Little Trek was doing it a lot. You know, I know some other teams were doing it as well. So I think maybe some teams are using other methods and, you know, it's probably a lot more convenient for the teams to do that than like sending a whole team to altitude because like that's a huge investment, time, money, everything.
Two things, which is going to be the first team to do a training camp at Death Valley, given what you've just said. And two, explain Mads Pedersen, who is both at sea level and in cold, dank, rainy Denmark.
He did seem to be doing... No, he's actually in Monaco now.
Oh, okay.
But he did seem to be doing a lot of heat training. So he was always like posting heat training stuff. Some people think it's because he moved to Monaco and now he's doing all these climbs that he was so good. But I mean, he was flying. I mean, in Paris, it was just insane. So, maybe this heat training really helped him. But I also think he's someone who doesn't like altitude, if I recall correctly. Maybe he just decided to go all in on this heat stuff and seemed to have a good effect. I mean, I would say Wout van Aert, you know, maybe going to altitude wasn't the right decision. But at the same time, it's worked in the past. I mean, it also worked really well for Matteo Jorgensen. You know, you see how he was flying and he also was at altitude, just before that whole block. So, you know, I don't think you can just say that like a one-off time, Wout didn't perform as well as everyone expected him to. He was still quite good. You know, I mean, maybe if he didn't go to altitude, he would have been worse. You know, we don't really know. And I think that's hard to just like cherry pick one time in one season, you know, out of a lot of years, you know, so I wouldn't say like just because it didn't work this time or he didn't have maybe as good a shape as he had in the past relative to the other guys. I wouldn't say that doesn't mean that altitude works or isn't the best prep for the classics, you know, but I'm not saying it is either. I just think there's so much more to it.
The other thing from Kurovic's corner is how brutal young children can be in their assessment of performance. I mean, you know, take that. The Flemish press have got nothing on Wout van Aert's child there with the why did you finish fourth again? worse than anything on social media.
A young man after Kurovic's heart. Larry, I hate to break it to you, but I think Wout van Aert will be putting the hurt on you at the Giro d'Italia is my prediction. He was sort of, I think I said on the podcast last week as well that he looked like a man who was training for the Giro d'Italia. And I think, particularly the third stage in Albania is going to suit him particularly well, maybe the time trial.
Even the first stage. I mean, the first stage is like, I think it's going to be 50-man sprint or something. So
yeah, but these it's an interesting topic, isn't it? The altitude. Again, I talked about the fetishization, the cult of youth. There's been a cult of altitude training over the last 10 years or so, and these things are always cyclical, and something will probably replace it. I said to you guys before we started recording today, I was having a chat with a World Tour team manager a couple of weeks ago. I won't reveal who it was, but he was very sheepish about the extortionate or the exorbitant number of days that his team had booked at the Teide in the Parador on in Tenerife. Hundreds of days, hundreds of hotel room bookings for a year for the men's and women's team. And yes, some teams have really, really gone all in.
I don't think it'll ever be replaced. I mean, I think there's quite enough good data that shows that it works. You know, I think when you see up here, there's so many of the best, you know, Ingebrigtsen's up here right now, just next door. So probably fastest 1500 meter runner ever. The Norwegian triathletes were also here, our friends. So, you know, I think those people wouldn't all be here if it didn't work. And I think it's just maybe in the future it'll be used slightly more sparingly. But I think we also have a unique sport where, like, you know, we race so much. And I think that's where we're still trying to figure out, you know, how to fit it into the calendar.
The Unchained series on Netflix didn't quite work out. So maybe the next level is some kind of reality show. 100 pro cyclists all living in a confined space on Tenerife. Somebody gets voted out every week. I can see that's got legs.
I can see Marc Soler being the last man standing. It would certainly, anything that he featured in would certainly be compelling viewing. Larry, you said you watched the classics, and as we said, these were very much characterized by the Van der Poel Pogacar duel. Now we know Pogacar is your whipping boy in training, rides on the Côte d'Azur. Can you reveal who you were? Did you have any, were you sort of partial, partisan towards any of the two, either of the two?
Yeah, I mean, for sure I wanted Pogacar to win Paris-Roubaix just because I thought it'd be pretty cool. Like, I just thought already the fact that he was racing it was really cool because, you know, just I think he's changing how we look at cycling in general. And, you know, I guess I'm always someone who's thought, like, if you're strong, you're strong, you know, and it doesn't mean you can't do any of these other races. Like, to perform in the Grand Tours, you have to be the strongest, you know. And I think in the past, the classics were perhaps slightly more open in terms of physiologically, because like you could be a super good racer and you could overcome perhaps a slight physiological deficit to some other riders because you're so good at racing, you know, and you're really good at positioning and being in the right place at the right time and, you know, fighting for position, everything like that. Now he's showing that like anyone can do this, you know, as in if you're strong enough, you can do any of these races and do well. And obviously he's such a light year ahead of almost everyone that like it's maybe easy to say, but I still think it was pretty cool because there aren't many climbers in the past who have raced Paris-Roubaix, and I just like the fact that he's showing what is possible. And you know, I think the other thing that's cool is that, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, he's too light, but I think one thing technology has really opened the door for is smaller guys being able to perform in races like Roubaix. You know, I think for me, the number one reason that he's able to do as well as he is now, relative to perhaps like 10 years ago, is just the tires and the tire pressure. So, you know, now I think most guys are racing on 32. I saw even Intermarché race 35C tires. And we're riding such low tire pressures that like, yeah, it makes it possible for a lighter guy to perform as well. Because, you know, when back in the day when everyone's riding 8 bar, you know, obviously for the bigger guys, it's going to be slightly easier because their tires are going to deform more. And now we're just realizing that, like, that's individual. You know, you can't just put everyone at 8 bar and then just send them on their way. Yeah. I mean, I think we might even discuss this more later on. But yeah, I think that's an interesting sort of nugget. And anyway, I was rooting for Pogacar, but it was clear that Vanderpool was stronger. But I think what's cool is the fact that Tadej got second means like he's definitely coming back and we'll see some good battles in the future.
Talking of Pogacar's tyres, yesterday I heard a story, Larry, maybe you can confirm this for me, that did he ride time trial tyres throughout the Tour de France last year? I don't know how common this is, which are thinner than normal tyres. Yeah. And because I know another rider who rode the same tyres, and for whom they disintegrated after about 70 kilometers of one stage, and they had to be replaced.
So the entire UAE team rides TT tires in like every single race. Same with Ineos, same with almost every team that is on Continental rides the TT tire. Last year, Decathlon, we did not because they were too worried it was going to flat too much. But honestly, like, I mean, looking at all the other teams, they didn't flat very much. And I think the only difference between the TT tire and the normal tire, so these are like the Continental GP 5000, which is, you know, like the flagship tire of Continental. They have three different tires. They have the TT, the S, and then the AS. And the TT, obviously, is like the fastest, normally made for time trials. There's no puncture protection. Like, there's no extra strip of puncture protection. Then there's the S, which is like the standard all-around tire. So that's what we raced on the whole season last year. So there's like one layer of puncture protection, but they're still quite quick. And then the AS is like the all-season, which I don't know, there might even be extra puncture protection and maybe have slightly more grip. It might even be a different compound in the AS because like it's, yeah, it's supposed to be also for winter and wet riding and whatever. So what I saw was that like Tadej rode the S in Paris-Roubaix. So the normal one was slightly more puncture protection than the TT. And then I saw that not Intermarché. Some other team was riding AS, I saw, which is a lot slower. So that's kind of interesting. Because yeah, the rolling resistance between different tires can be like enormous and make a huge difference in performance.
Is this where these self-inflating tyres come into play, the Grava tyres, which they've been in development for quite a long time, but the first time that I really heard about them was at the UCI Gravel Worlds in Leuven last October. Marianne Vos was riding them, and there's a button on the handlebars, I think, you can inflate and deflate. So in a race like Paris-Roubaix or the Tour of Flanders, you can change the, change how hard your tyres are depending on whether you're on the pavé or on the tarmac.
Are they a bit like Reebok pump?
Yeah.
Excellent 90s reference there, Daniel. But it seems that, you know, if the margins are so fine, you know, when it comes to tyre choice even, that seems like quite an important development that we'll probably see more teams adopting.
Yeah, I would have thought that that had even a bigger impact. I mean, maybe it did. And, you know, we just didn't see that, like, the guys on those teams come to the forefront. But, like, you know, yeah, I guess knowing the difference in rolling resistance and different tire pressures and different tires, I would have thought that would have been, like, a huge thing. But what's interesting is what I had heard from our team is the difference between the lowest guy's tire pressure and the highest guy's tire pressure. So I looked, I saw like a photo. It was maybe like, I don't know, 0.3 bar or something. You know, it wasn't very much, maybe 0.4. So on the road, it made like, I think from the highest to the lowest, there was 10 watts difference of rolling resistance on the road. But then on the cobbles, it made 40 watts. So having like lower tire pressure is like enormously advantageous on the cobbles. And it's a little bit smaller of a penalty when you're on the road.
Wow. I never thought we'd spend 15 minutes on the cycling podcast talking about tires. Part three, handlebars.
I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
On Saturday, Stacey Snyder's classic cobbled mugs went on sale. A batch of those cups went on sale and they sold out, as they always do, very, very quickly. Well done if you managed to get your hands on one of those cups. They're being dispatched now and will be arriving at their destinations imminently, I guess. As I said, I think a week or so ago, Stacey's not doing cups for the Grand Tours this year, but there may well be another one-off batch of cups towards the end of the season. We'll keep you posted on that. The Cycling Podcast Feminin, the latest episode recorded largely on location at Paris-Roubaix Femmes with Rose Manley and Denny Gray, joined also by Rebecca Charlton. That is online now if you want to check that out. And there's a special episode of Kilometre Zero coming, a bonus episode. I've made a piece about the Cycle Classic, which is Britain's answer to Paris-Roubaix and the Tour of Flanders, really. And that will be on your Friends of the Podcast feed soon, imminently, perhaps over the Easter weekend. Just another little reminder that the Richard Moore Youth Race Series is taking place monthly up at the cycle circuit in Linlithgow in Scotland. If you go to the British Cycling website, you can enter those races for junior and young racers. I think the categories go from under 8s up to under 16, something like that. We'll keep you posted on how those races turn out. The first one is on Tuesday, April the 22nd. And finally, sign up for the 1101 Cappuccino. You'll get an update in your inbox automatically. It's free. Just go to thecyclingpodcast.com and sign up for it. It's distributed on Substack, a very popular thing these days, isn't it, Substack? We were kind of early-ish adopters, I guess, but everyone's doing one now.
Indeed, indeed. Everyone copied us.
Well, I wouldn't go Lionel, that far, but...
Yes, yes, they all did. Chaps, some other races to update listeners on if they missed them. At the weekend, there was a big World Tour race, of course, or the conclusion of a big World Tour race, Tour of the Basque Country, Itzulia. The winner, overall, was João Almeida, who also won the last stage in Eibar. João Almeida, who, of course, we sort of criticised, or I sort of criticised a few weeks ago. I think this was after Catalunya, saying that he'd let another opportunity slip by, an opportunity to lead UAE Team Emirates. He had a few near misses, and indeed, that Tour of the Basque Country victory was his first sort of major win in a stage race. He did it by... well, dethroning Max Schachmann, first of all, from the leadership after stage three. And then he successfully staved off Eric Mas in the last stage to Eibar. Did you chaps happen to see that last stage in the rain with Eric Mas asking, very politely, quite politely, asking João Almeida if he would let him have the stage? And João Almeida basically telling him to bugger off.
And then beating him in the sprint.
It was worth the try. It was worth a try. But confirming, Larry, confirming that kind of thing no longer really happens. There will still be circumstances where it does happen, but it's becoming rarer and rarer that we get that sort of quid pro quo arrangement of you have the stage while I take the GC, or you have the stage and I'll have a favour in a few weeks' time at a different race.
Important win that for Almeida, really, wasn't it? He has won a World Tour stage race before, the Tour of Poland in 2021, but not quite the same sort of category as Itzulia, really. Almeida was in danger of becoming the sort of stage racer that doesn't win stage races, wasn't he? That category is now firmly led by Enric Mas, who, I mean, it's amazing, really, given his talent, given his podium finishes, especially in the Vuelta, but he's never won a World Tour stage race. I mean, maybe he hasn't asked politely enough. I don't know.
Yeah, there you go. I always feel he's an easy man to criticise, Enric Mas, but I'm a bit of an Enric Mas loyalist. I always sympathise with him a little bit, but just because I see that he gets dog's abuse on social media from Spanish cycling fans. And he's a very fine rider and has had a very fine career, particularly in the Vuelta a España. Lionel should also have mentioned that Almeida, well, he also won stage four. Ben Healy, so his two stage wins, Joao Almeida's two stage wins, were the sort of bread in a sandwich made up by the filling of Ben Healy winning on stage five, shaping up very well for the Ardennes Classics, which we might mention in a minute. And Alex Aramburu of Cofidis now also won a stage. That was stage three, and that of course was important in another of the subjects, another of the recurring topics of the start of this season. That is the relegation battle. Cofidis, Arkea, Astana, Picnic et al.
I thought you were other talking race. About going the wrong way is also another theme in races this year.
Well, it is. It really is.
Ben Lionel. Healy won in a very Ben Healy fashion, didn't he? The sort of almost 50k break or whatever it was, won by a minute and 47 seconds. That's when we talk about, you know, Enric Mas and his characteristic being a stage racer who doesn't win stage races. I mean, Ben Healy, you kind of can pick just from looking at the two-dimensional profile of a stage or a race, you just know which races he's going to target. You could probably go through the Giro and look at the stages that would suit Ben Healy, and he's very good at that, isn't he, getting in those breaks and forcing his way up the road and riding very fast and eking out a gap that then grows out of control and finishing it off.
He reminds me what he did. He reminds me of that Bruce Lee, is it a Bruce Lee quote, I fear a man with one kick done 1,000 times more than I fear a man who with 1,000 kicks practiced once. Something like that.
Very profound.
Anyway, chaps, another stage race going on at the moment. Giro d'Abruzzo, also UAE doing very well there. Alessandro Covi won the first stage, and I believe at the time of recording is still leading general classification. But
Georg Zimmermann is now leading general classification.
Okay.
I watched the stage just before I got on the podcast, so anyway.
Glad you're here. Yeah. Glad you're here, Larry. Oh, and there was another UAE stage win there for Ivo Oliveira yesterday in the sprint. But chaps, as far as the World Tour is concerned, attention turning to the Ardennes, and before that, Amstel Gold at the weekend. Larry, how come you're giving the Ardennes a swerve this year?
I would have been happy to do them. But, you know, I think for the Giro, they wanted us to have sort of like the optimal preparation. And yeah, we did this altitude camp and then Tour of the Alps before the Giro, which to me, I do think is the best possible prep. The Ardennes are nice. I always love doing the Ardennes, done them quite a few times. But, you know, I don't know, sitting like 9 days in a hotel in Belgium, eating too much food is not like the best prep for the Giro. You know, I mean, they're three really good races. You know, if you count the biggest ones, if you count like Brabant-Séphel as the sort of lead-in race. I mean, really super races I really like a lot. And I do think, you know, you get probably a really good also stimulus for the Giro if you do those races. But, you know, I think the thing is the amount, you know, you have to load, you have to, you know, like carbo load, you have to, you know, then do the race, you eat like crazy, you have to recover, and then you take a couple of days off, rest. And I think it's really hard to even maintain the same weight over that whole week. So usually if you do the Ardennes, it's almost like you gain a kilo because you keep like, you know, you have to just smash food the whole time.
A whole kilo. Imagine that.
I know. But the problem is when you're getting ready for a Grand Tour and you're trying to get down to
you're going
to
say
lightest,
10 kilos.
Nah, I mean, maybe, I don't know, maybe two. I don't know. I mean, two even seems excessive, but you go in the wrong direction rather than the right direction. And I think just having a stage race with short, intense stages that you can go to straight from altitude is probably the optimal preparation. So, I mean, I've done both, and I think really Tour of the Alps is the best way to do it. If you're looking towards the Giro, I mean, most people going to the Ardennes are looking towards the Ardennes and not the Giro. So it's a different story. But I think, yeah, I'm looking forward to watching because I think we have a really good team for the Ardennes with Mark Hirschi and Julian Alaphilippe. So, yeah, I think it'll be cool to see Tudor hopefully performing well.
I hope those chaps get on, Larry, because they're very similar riders, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, but they're so chill. Both of them are really cool guys. And, yeah, I couldn't see them getting not along on with many people. So, yeah, I think they get along pretty well. It's cool.
Larry, on the subject of carb loading, feeding, weight gain, we have talked a lot over the last couple of years about the carbohydrate revolution and taking on more and more carbs during races, during training. I'm just curious, this year, has there been another slight sort of leap in terms of what you're consuming in races, or are you more or less where you were in the last couple of years? Are we talking 100 grams, 120 grams?
I think now I may be more open to even going higher, but maybe not, like not being like, oh my God, I just did 120, I'll stop there, you know? Now I'm just like, whatever, you know, and that's what I think a lot of guys are like, if they go up to 160, 200 grams for an hour in a race where they're just like, they stop counting, they're just smashing gels, you know, I think that happens. So I think it's more like guys are just like, okay, I need to make sure I have at least enough. And then if I go higher, whatever, whereas before maybe it was like, oh, you know, I better stop at 120 because maybe my stomach will hurt or something. So I think no one's
200 was uncharted territory until recently, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I would say most, it's not like many guys are doing 200 the whole day, you know, like, but maybe for a certain hour, you know, like maybe say you go over a climb, you go down the descent, you know, so maybe you missed like 45 minutes of fueling. Maybe you get into the next valley and you just like bang, 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 like a few gels and then drink some mix and all of a sudden it's 200 in an hour, you know? So I'm just saying, like, maybe 1 hour in the race, you're hitting 200, not like average for the whole day. But yeah, I do think we're going to still see people creeping up higher than 120. And yeah, I mean, now I think the difference is a lot of guys are doing 120 in training a lot of days. So
whereas, yeah, I was going to say, is that... No, well, I was going to ask about, because you've got the Giro coming up, of course, and you'll have that on a daily basis. You'll be consuming that of that order. Do you have to train? We know you have to train your gut generally. Do you get to a point where it is sort of second nature and there's no additional training you have to do? Or do you have to specifically train your gut for a Grand Tour?
No, yeah. I mean, I think you kind of just get to a point. And especially if you've been racing for a bit, you're eating so much at the race that you're going to already be trained. Your gut's going to be trained. So, you know, I would say here, I wouldn't ever on a day be like, today I'm doing gut training, you know, but I would be probably doing 100 an hour in a lot of the training sessions just because, not for like the purpose of being like, I need to get ready to do this for the race, but because I need to fuel the training. So I think in the end, just the way that we're fueling now in training, your gut is just trained, you know, like, because we consume so much so often, but not necessarily every day, but frequently.
Has anyone studied the impact of altitude on carbohydrate consumption?
No, but I mean, I would say it's probably good to up your carbs a bit because I think you burn more carbs at altitude.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Larry, you talked about the very harmonious relationship between Mark Hirschi and Julian Alaphilippe. You mentioned that you're at altitude with Michael Storer, Florian Storck, and the other one who's just arrived, Rick Plummers. Michael Storer, unpack the myth, the riddle wrapped in an enigma, wrapped in a puzzle that is Michael Storer, because he's an intriguing rider. The first thing that was intriguing about him years ago when he started his pro career was that he was living in Glasgow. I think he had a Scottish girlfriend at the time.
His and Italian since girlfriend then, was studying there, but yeah.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
And since then, he has occasionally produced these incredible performances, for example, winning two stages at the Vuelta 1 year. He's a very softly spoken chap, but anyone who's trained with him, anyone who's been a teammate of his, for example, Romain Bardet, has talked about what an extraordinary engine the guy has got. And he is, I mean, I hate this nickname when people pull this out, but he is the sort of archetypal baby-faced assassin. He doesn't look like a guy who would have an enormous, murderous engine.
100%. No, he doesn't look like that at all, but he has a very, very fine engine. So, I mean, yeah, if we do like efforts, I mean, he just blows everyone out of the water. I mean, it's insane. He's like super strong, like astronomical numbers. And yeah, it's just funny because, yeah, he's kind of an unassuming package, you know. But yeah, for example, even on one training day, it was the three of us, like Michael, Florian and I training together. And I think it was a 6-hour day. And for the 6 hours, Florian and I just rotated, taking turns next to Michael and on the back. And I don't think Michael ever swapped off, except on false flat downhills, because he doesn't like to get aero. So yeah. But yeah, he has a big engine. And I think we might see some big things from him in the Giro this year. So he's definitely in good shape.
Is Larry Walbass in great shape?
I actually think the three of us are in really good shape, so that's cool.
Shall we turn our attention to the races that are to come over the next week or so? We had on Wednesday the Ronde van Limburg, which is sort of the real gateway between the cobbled races and the hillier races in, well, the Netherlands and the Ardennes in the Walloon region of Belgium. The Ronde van Limburg was... where it finished with a sprint, two riders called Milan on the podium. Milan Fretin of Cofidis, crucial points for them in the relegation battle. Milan Menten of Lotto was third. We just needed Jonathan Milan in there somewhere or other to make it a Milan clean sweep of the podium. And we're recording on Thursday, the day before the eagerly anticipated return to racing of Remco Evenepoel, Sudal Quickstep rider who's been out of action since getting knocked off his bike in training earlier this year. He hasn't raced since Lombardia last October, where he was second behind you-know-who, Tadej Pogacar. So Brabantse Pale on Friday moved its date. It's recently been held on the Wednesday afternoon, hasn't it? But now, well, on the Wednesday. But now it's moved to Friday, 2 days before Amstel Gold. Strong field. Whether it's an advantage or a disadvantage to be racing on Friday ahead of Amstel Gold on Sunday, I don't know. But Remco Evenepoel will also go up against Wout van Aert, Tadej Pogacar in the Amstel Gold race. Tadej Pogacar is currently on the start list for the three races, Amstel Gold, Flèche Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège. So he's, you know, it was Mads Pedersen who talked about them, the monsters, wasn't it? Well, the monster is carrying on for a full classics campaign by the looks of it.
That's if Pogacar can repair the enormous, I don't know what it was on his wrist, or the gouge created on his wrist by that watch digging into him, Paris-Roubaix. That Richard Miller watch. Yes, Larry, Lionel, any predictions for, well, Remco in those races and Pogacar? Should we expect Pogacar a clean sweep?
I'd say so. I mean, to be honest, I just don't see many guys competing with him. The fact that he was so good in the flatter races, I just don't see, once they hit the climbs, anyone even coming close.
It's a long old campaign, though, isn't it? I mean, he's been really on since Milan-San Remo, which is already a month ago. Is that a factor, do you think?
I mean, I think it can be a little bit of mental fatigue, but I think if you're successful as he is, I think you aren't too drained by it. But, you know, I think the other thing is, to me, they've managed it quite well because he hasn't really done any of the small races in between. You know, he's really only done big races. And then I think he goes home, you know, enjoys time with his girlfriend, training in Monaco. So I think the thing that really fatigues you is staying at a hotel in Belgium in the middle of Flanders for 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks, not seeing your family, not seeing your friends. And
just eating.
Just eating, you know? So I think the thing is the way he did it is a lot more refreshing mentally, and I think that's a big component.
Larry, last thing on Pogacar from me anyway. You talked earlier about tyres, yeah, and how that's made things easier for lighter riders. Anecdotally, have you heard that the tyres as well, they make a big difference to how people recover from Paris-Roubaix, in the same way that, for example, nowadays running shoes are such that it's no longer accepted after a marathon that people are going to not be able to run for a few days. You can run the next day.
I think you're going to have less blisters on your hands and things like that, and maybe your butt won't hurt as much. But I think the fatigue from Paris-Roubaix is like more of the effort. Pogacar was saying it was like the hardest race he's ever done. So, you know, I think the tires, okay, you're going to be maybe less sore, but I think you're going to be equally as fatigued because it's just a gigantic, super hard race.
What about Remco Evenepoel then? Any whispers in the peloton about what to expect from him and on his comeback race? I mean, that crash I talked about, apparently, according to the reports, he rode into an open door on a post van in Belgium in early December, fractured his ribs and shoulder blade and his hand as well. Has been off the bike, obviously, in the run-up to Christmas. And this is his first race back. Always difficult, I guess, to know, you know, how someone will go when they're back in competitive action for the first time in a while.
Yeah, he was also in Sierra Nevada. We passed him a few times in training, going the other direction. I'm sure he'll be in great shape. You know, I mean, he's always ready when he gets to his objectives. And I don't think he'd be participating in these races now if he wasn't going to be competitive. But I still don't see him being at the same level as Tade.
There you have it. Well, chaps, we are now within, the last month before the Giro d'Italia. Larry, how much longer are you up there?
Two more days. We leave the day after tomorrow and then we head straight to Tour of the Alps.
Okay, then Tour of the Alps. Well, Larry, we're expecting to be graced by your presence at the Giro. Very kindly, Tudor Pro Cycling going to be paying your expenses, not us.
Oh, yeah, great.
And you're also going to be riding the course for us every day, which and bring your insight, which is fantastic. But yes, we very much look forward to that, Larry. And we look forward to maybe we might even have you on before the Giro to find out how preparations are going and just how many minutes Michael Storer is going to win the general classification by. But in the meantime, have a safe journey down and to the Tour of the Alps next week.
Sounds great. We will be
watching with great interest.
Thank you. Should be good.
I've got a big question, Larry. I'm doing the first 7 days of the Giro. How many carbs do I need to eat and how high up at altitude do I need to get? It's pretty flat around here in Not Watford.
Oof, I don't know about the altitude. Yeah, maybe you should get a tent to get ready for the Giro. You can sleep in that up there. And then, yeah, maybe you should start training your gut because there's a lot of good pasta in Italy. So I'm sure you're going to be consuming plenty of carbs and enjoying it probably more than we are.
We all know the only training that Larry really should have been doing, the only adaptation work should have been rain adaptation because it's going to be foul at the Giro
first
week.
I actually had this suggestion one day. It was like terrible weather. I was like, whatever, let's just train for the Giro. I was very quickly vetoed and we did not train that day. So we rearranged the training, which was more pleasant, I can definitely admit. But I thought it'd be an opportunity to test all the rain gear, you know, but that was put down.
Another day. Well, Larry, thank you very much and we'll speak to you soon.
Thanks, guys.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.